Okay. Now, if you take a look at this verse, I haven't checked it in English, but in Hebrew, it comes out that this verse breaks up into seven components, okay? And that, in other words, the verse itself can be broken up into, it breaks up naturally into seven components. And we will see that every one of these components happens to contain, in a logical way, a reference to the seven commandments. All right? Now, when I said, and let me just clarify this, because you're not used to this style. But the way Torah is written, this is part of the oral law. The Torah is written in a way that it's God's infinite wisdom, and there are, you maybe may have heard, codes of the Torah. So there is infinite wisdom in God's Torah. So the Torah is written on different levels. There's a plain reading, okay? But then it's also written with an eye for the deeper understanding. And that I think you're familiar with. If you analyze the text, many times you see dialogues don't make sense. You take a look, you look a little deeper, you'll see a deep concept there, and everything fits in very smoothly. There are several methods, though, however, that we have from Sinai of analyzing the Torah. One of the things, of course, probably the one that is most often used is the fact that the extra words. There are no extra words in the Torah. But there is a method of reference. Now, the method of reference is if you have a word, and then there is, this word is mentioned in another place, and the meaning is found in the second place, it's expanded upon, then the first place also is a reference to that. In other words, it's like an equation. Like you say, a word over here and a word in another place, whatever the word in the other place means in the expanded version is also a reference, also means the same thing in this verse. Okay? So we learn by way of reference. In other words, like extrapolation. You extrapolate from one area to another area. Now, over here, in this case, what the Talmud is saying, and the Talmud, there's an argument about this. Not everyone accepted this. the Talmud is a search for God's knowledge, and it has to be rational, it has to make sense. Rabbi Yochanan says, this position of the Talmud is, that it is an amazing fact that this verse, which has to do with the essence of man, the first time where the Torah explains to us, in the second account, what man's essence is, that this verse happens to break down naturally into seven components, okay? That strikes one as a sign that there may be something more here. Let's check into this, okay? That's like a little light over here. Now, when the Talmud does check into it, it discovers, amazingly, that every one of these words, without going too far off course, can be seen as a reference to one of the seven laws. And we're going to go into these words, and we'll show exactly how it works. Now, as I told you, one of the methods of the Torah is to the cross-referencing. All right. Now, through cross-referencing, and also through an understanding of the word itself, in its most primary sense, we'll see that there's an amazing thing about this verse. It happens to break down into seven components, and those seven components happen to be the seven laws. Now, don't expect to find, since this is the method of reference, so the method of reference is not overt, but then again, it's not completely wild either. There is something to it. In other words, when we look at it, we'll see that it is an amazing thing, that it just happens to break down to these seven words, and these seven words are allusions, without going too far, of course, to the seven laws. Okay? So if we've got that much, we're going to proceed. Okay. Now, the first word is, in Hebrew, is Vayetzav, and he commanded. You understand? When you read the translation, you're not going to have the same order as you do have in the Hebrew. The translation is said, and then it used the word Elohim. Of course, I say Elohim. The last syllable is him, but I always say kim because I don't want to pronounce God's name. So the so just remember that. Now, the first word, if you read it in English, it'll say, "And God Almighty commanded." That's because in English, the subject comes first. But in Hebrew, it doesn't work that way. In Hebrew, the first word is, "And he commanded." Then comes the subject, okay? And you drop the pronoun when the subject follows, all right? It's a little complicated, but not that impossible to understand. So now let's take each word. The first word is basically the element of commanded. Okay, so the Talmud says the word commanded implies what? What does the word commanded imply? It implies commandments, keeping of commandments, and a system of commandments. And this we find a cross-reference in Genesis 18, where God says about Abraham, because I know him in order that he should command his sons, his children after him. His household after him. Now, this word command, you see, is not just used as a single command, but rather it's saying that Abraham will command his sons, his family, his household after him to keep the way of God, which means to say the whole system of God, God's whole system, will be kept by Abraham. So it's speaking about keeping the entire system. In other words, God is saying about Abraham, because I know Abraham, he is a type of person, that he will keep my system for himself and for his family afterwards, and they will keep the way of God to do justice and righteousness. In other words, he's a guardian of the system. So the word command over there means not just a single commandment, but it means keeping the entire system of commandments. All right? We have the same exact word over there. Now, over there, the word means being a guardian of the system. So the Talmud says, so we have a right to say that the word over here, not in its primary sense, not in its plain sense, but in its reference sense, is also referring to the concept of guarding the commandments. Not just keeping a commandment, but guarding a commandment. And that is one of the laws of the B'nai Noach, which is to not just to keep the individual commandments, but to guard the entire system. Okay, just like Abraham, he kept the entire system. So we see by cross-referencing that the word command doesn't only mean to keep a single command, but it means to keep the whole system of commandments. So therefore, we can say, by way of reference, that this first word, by itself, command, means keeping the system of commandments, which means the seventh law for the Ben Noach to make sure that God's commandments, his system, is kept. Okay? That's one. Two, the second word in that verse is God. Okay, now this word, this God, two references to God. One is Ado Shem, and that is the tetragrammaton, the four-letter word, okay? And that's the first reference to God. The second reference to God is Elohim, which means Almighty. But let's take the first one. Now the first one is, now you see there's a double reference to God in this verse. Now the first reference is the name of God, which is the highest name that we have in reference to God in the Torah. Now the Talmud says again that this name is referring to the violation, the prohibition against profaning God's name, blasphemy, which we studied at length on the tapes, last year. And we remember that primarily, that in order to violate that law, one must use that name of God. So we see that the name of God and keeping the name of God holy means refraining from blasphemy with regard to that name. So there again, you have the name. There is one of the seven laws of Noah has to do with the name, and with this name, okay, and this name in specific. So they have a reference to the second law. Then you have the third word is Elohim. Elohim means God in the sense that God is almighty, all right, all powerful, multi-powerful. That's why it's pluralized. Christians always try to read into the pluralization. But the pluralization is not a reference. reference, of course, to pluralization, heaven forbid, with regard to the creator, but it means multi-powerful. That's why it's in the plural. And that name is used not only for God, but the name is used also for a prince or someone who is in a high position of power. But when we mention it ordinarily, in this verse, of course, it's in reference to God. But the Talmud says that if we use the system of cross, we find that that word is also mentioned in the Ten Commandments, where it says, you shall not have before me, and there it uses the word Elohim again, but it says Elohim Acherim, which means, and this has to be very carefully translated, most people translate, thou shalt not have any other gods before me. Now, that is a dangerous statement, because there are no other gods. As a matter of fact, I mean, you're studying Isaiah, I know, and Isaiah 37, 19 says, and he will put their gods in fire because they are not gods, but they are only the handiwork of man. They are wood and stone, okay? So there are no other gods, all right? There's only one God. Now, the reason why the Rashi's translation, there are several interpretations to that phrase, but the simplest one actually is Rashi. Rashi says that in Hebrew, there is such a thing called smichus, which means if you have two words together, there's an of that's understood there. And that is found in the Torah. That's a rule in the Hebrew grammar. So Rashi says the proper translation is not other gods, but gods of others. All right? That's what it means. Elohim shel acherim. Yes, the of is understood, but when the two words are close together, they're referenced to possessive. So it means the gods of others. But at any rate, getting back to this piece of Talmud here, so the Talmud says, now that word Elohim means that there is only one Almighty, and there shouldn't, and a person should not, because when you speak about the gods of others, you're saying those, that thing which others consider as Almighty. Now you couldn't use the first name of God, because that is a reference to the real God. But the second term, which implies that God is all-powerful, multi-powerful, so there, that term can be used with reference to idols or stars or other forces, insofar as other people claim or believe that these things are all-powerful. Okay? So, therefore, the Talmud says, that second name of God is there because it has a double reference. It means he, the true God, is the one that should be your Almighty, and not... You should not make Almighty the gods of others, all right? And the same word, Elohim, is used in relationship to God, and it's also used in relationship to the false gods or the gods of others. So therefore, the Talmud says that it is not too difficult, if we're looking for reference, by way of reference, to see how this word over here is a reference to the violation of idolatry, because it means... The one that in your mind should be all-powerful is the true God, and you should not ascribe any type of power to any other forces. Okay? So that's the third element in the verse. Now we continue. It says, Al Ha'adam, okay, which means on, God commanded on the man. Now here, many times, the way we derive that there is something a little bit off, a little awry in the verse. It's not smooth. Whenever the Torah is not smooth, it means it wants to give you another idea, a side idea, as it's talking. So it changes something which makes it a little rough, but if you look into it, you'll see that the reason why it's rough is because it's trying to teach you something else also. It's trying to teach you two things at once. And the Talmud uses that method over here, because it says that God Almighty commanded, and it says, on the man. It doesn't say to the man, but it says on the man, okay? Now, on the man could be translated also as about or concerning the man, all right? So, therefore, the Talmud says that, not in the literal sense, but in the reference method, we see the Torah went out of its way to change something, to make it unsmooth, and it says, God commanded about the man. Now, what is there to command about the man? Okay? So the Talmud says, there is the most essential thing, if you're going to give a commandment to a human being about man, the most essential commandment you give him is not to kill man, not to destroy man. And that's why it quotes the verse later on in Genesis, where it says, he who spills the blood of the man shall his own blood be spilt. Okay? So the Torah is the by saying, by going a little bit off course and saying that God commanded about the man, well, what is the major, the most major commandment that you can give man about his fellow man? Well, the most major thing you can do is, most primary thing you can do is, command not to destroy the other man. Okay? So, again, if you take that component of the verse, there is, without, by way of reference, there is a clear connection between that word and the commandment, which is a prohibition against murder of man. Okay, now the next word there is lamor. Lamor is saying. Now this one is not as easy as the other ones. The other ones go along pretty smoothly. This one is a little difficult, because here the Talmud makes a very strange cross-reference. The cross-reference it gives is Jeremiah 3. All right? Now Jeremiah 3 is a very strange cross-reference, because you could give cross-references about the five books of Moses within the five books of Moses. That's legitimate, because those are all one entity given by God to Moses at Sinai, and they're all one unit. So the system is made to cross-reference from any one place to another place. That's the way it was built. That's the way God constructed the Torah. That's the hidden aspects of the Torah, the code system of the Torah. But of course, Jeremiah was not given, as we understand it, at Sinai. So the question is, how could the Talmud possibly use a cross reference to Jeremiah? That would seem to be not a legitimate method. Okay, but we'll see that the if we understand the concept, we'll see how this works. And we'll see, it's not precisely a cross-reference. Now, what the Talmud is saying is as follows. Let me give the idea for. Oh, let me get first. The verse is Jeremiah 3:1. I didn't look at any English translation, so I don't know exactly how to translate. But in Hebrew, it says, you have the word lamor. Now, lamor usually is something which follows a verse. In other words, and God spoke to Moses lamor. He spoke to him saying. All right. You don't start off a verse with lamor. It's not done. Okay. However, here is one time where it is done. And it's strange. But what it's talking about here in Jeremiah is that God is saying to the people that a man will send away his wife, and she'll leave him, and she'll live with another man. Will he get back to her? He won't, because he will feel that this woman has been disloyal to him. And God says, and you, the Jewish people, you have strayed from me. You have prostituted yourselves to others. But nevertheless, I say to you, return to me. Okay? So here, it's talking about, this is, of course, a parable found throughout the prophets, that when Israel strays, they're considered as if they are the disloyal wife of the Creator of God. All right? Now, The reason is why, just let me give you why you have that analogy. The analogy is very simple, because in the marriage bond, if one is disloyal, what does this mean? This means usually that the person that is being disloyal recognizes that it's not, speaking where the marriage is good, the partners are good to each other, and if one of them strays, in this case the woman strays, it means to say that she is making a mistake. Her mind would tell her not to do this. It's not just. It's not right. But she's caught up by the temptation of the moment and gives way to her emotions rather than to her judgment. That is the parable. Now, therefore, whenever the Torah says that Israel strayed from God, it gives that the perfect analogy. It means that Israel recognizes, or they should recognize at least, that God's path is the right path. Their mind should tell them this is right. But they're suddenly lured by the momentary attractions of the physical or the idolatrous, some attraction there that captivates them, and they follow the captivating emotion rather than what their mind tells them to be correct. So that's why that analogy is always used. Now, over here, Jeremiah is using that same analogy. All right, so he's using the analogy of the woman that strays away from her good husband, and she strays because she's lured momentarily by desire, all right, by emotion rather than her mind, rather than following her mind. And Jeremiah introduces this whole little parable with that word lamor. Now, it's very strange because, as I said, lamor usually is the last word in the sentence, not the first, okay? So the question is, why did Jeremiah himself made this little change, this little rough spot in formulating his speech over here? And the Talmud is saying as follows, that Jeremiah is teaching you also, parenthetically, a concept, an idea of Torah. And that is that in man, when man strays, when a person is involved in illicit sexual activity, it's not, as most people think, just because of physical desire. It really is because of a lure of the mind and a luring of the, I don't mean the mind in terms of intellect, I mean in terms of fantasy, and this is always expressed in speech in a human being. Speech is the vehicle through which man expresses his desires and his instincts. And what Jeremiah is teaching here by putting that word in the beginning is, through speech, the instinctual part of man always takes form. It's not simply like an animal has physical desire. Man doesn't have raw physical desire. Man's desire is subtle. And the desire comes about through speech as the main component of an illicit affair. Illicit affair is speech. 99.9% of the affair is speaking. The act is only a very short moment, but the speaking, the instinctual talk, and the speech that is involved in the affair is really the essence in man. This is found really in the Torah in several places. You have by the case of Shechem, if you remember, when he fell in love with Dinah. So there the Bible says, and he spoke upon the heart of the young girl. Okay? So, again, he spoke. Speech is used as the seduction of speech. But I think the most glaring example really is in Proverbs 7. And it's a beautiful, Proverbs 7 is really something beautiful, something everybody should read. I think it's one of the most beautiful parables on description of how man follows his emotions and not his senses. And it gives the description of a person that's lured by the evil woman. The evil woman really is referring to the prostitute here is an example of the emotions of man, how they lure him and fool him. But the description is interesting because it says, King Solomon describes how he's looking out of his window and he sees a young person that doesn't have any knowledge or understanding, and he's watching him being lured by these desires, and he knows exactly what's going to happen to him, but the person that's being lured doesn't recognize this at all. They think they're going for something good, and then they finally, when it's too late, they realize that they lost their life. So he gives this beautiful description here. And then when he has, it's interesting, but when he has the prostitute finally meets this young, ignorant person, first it shows how he goes around the corner, which means to say that he really is going there for a reason. It's not an accident. He's looking for something. And then when she grabs him and she kisses him, but then the verse 14 and 15 and 14 and 18, 19 is all those verses, so many verses, tell you what she says to him, the speech, the way she speaks to him. She tries to show him she's fine, she's paid her obligations, and then she lures him, and the whole approach is actually a description of how the fantasy of man just lures him, and but it's all speech. The example's all given in speech, and then he sums it up, and he says in verse 21, he says, "With her much fair speech, she causes him to yield. With the smoothness of her lips, she seduces him." So you see, from this, from Proverbs, the concept in the Torah, that really it is the speech of man that is mainly involved in the seductive process. And that's why in the Talmud you have so many prohibitions against certain types of speech, which the Talmud says that if one engages in that kind of speech, it leads to a process where the instinctual is awakened, and if the person follows those emotions, then they could actually destroy themselves spiritually. So seduction and speech are really, a certain type of speech are synonymous. Now, what the Talmud is saying is like this, that word lamar means to say, to speak. And the Talmud says that Jeremiah purposely introduces his parable with that word in a strange way in order to reflect that concept, that same word lamar. The word reflects the idea that the seductive process in man is not simply physical, but it really is one of talking and speaking, which is the main medium of involving oneself in the seductive process. So, therefore, the Talmud says that the word lamar over here, saying, can also be understood as the seductive speech, which plays a big role in Torah and in the prophets. Okay? So it's not too far-fetched to use that word to indicate the violation against illicit sexual affairs. Okay. Then, the Talmud continues, and it says that we did already, I believe, four references, correct? Five. We have five ready. And now we come to where it says, from all the trees of the garden, all right? And the Talmud says...
Rev.